HuntStand is the most popular and functional mobile hunting app on the market. With a variety of base maps to choose from, satellite imagery that is updated every month, the ability to check the weather, know property information, and even catalog your trail cam pics, HuntStand even gives you the ability to import pins and location markers from other mobile apps. Visit HuntStand.com or download wherever you download your apps. Enter discount code SN20 at checkout for 20% off.
What is going on, everyone? Welcome back to another episode of the Wisconsin Sportsman Podcast, which is brought to you by Tacticam. This is your home for all things outdoors in the Badger State, and I'm your host, Josh Rayleigh. Thank you so much for tuning in this week. We've got a fantastic episode in store for you today. I got a chance to record with a buddy of mine, Alex Gramavat. He's originally from Florida, moved to southern Wisconsin a couple of years ago. So he and I are both transplants to the state. We've had similar experience moving here to Wisconsin and finding a whole host of outdoor opportunities. We talk about his growing up in a non-hunting family, how he transitioned from a non-hunter, possibly even anti-hunting, to where he is now as a pure opportunist. He's literally doing something outside no matter the season. He embraces whatever the season has to offer. He hunts, he fishes, he forages and hikes and gardens and trains his bird dog. You name it, Alex does it. He also had an opportunity to harvest a great buck on public land this past gun season, and he shares that story in this episode. If you're not already, go ahead and subscribe to this podcast so you don't miss a single episode. Leave a 5-star review if you enjoy the content. It helps us spread the word. If you're downloading on Apple Podcasts, which it looks like most of you are, leave us a written review. Let me know what you think of the show. Rate us on Spotify if you tune in there. Also, follow along with us on Instagram. Probably the best thing that you can do, though, is to share this podcast with your buddies, others who also love the outdoors and are passionate about our natural resources. Also on Instagram, tag me in your photos. I'll share those so that we can collectively highlight all that this great state has to offer, even during this somewhat unbearable July heat wave that we've had going on here the last week or so. Before we jump in, got to give a huge shout out to our partners who make this show possible. First and foremost, Tacticam, the title sponsor of this show, the first partner of this show. Great people over at Tacticam. We actually have an episode with them coming up here in the next couple of weeks. I've been holding on to that episode, though. We talked about a few products that just weren't ready to be talked about just yet. So I do just want to say this, though. The Reveal X Gen 2 cameras are absolutely amazing. And their customer support is second to none, in my opinion. I had a little issue this past week getting two of my cameras connected. I gave a call to customer service. They had a callback option. They called me back, had me squared away in a matter of minutes. Fantastic customer support, which is way more than you can say for pretty much any other trail camera in this price point. Go check them out. You won't be disappointed. Tacticam.com or RevealCellCam.com. Next up, Deer Lab. I absolutely love this app. It helps me keep track of all of my photos, helps me keep track of my cameras. It allows you to create individual profiles for a specific deer, syncs photos with local weather so that you're not having to go back and manually check what the weather was doing when you got pictures of that shooter that you're trying to hone in on. Go start your free trial today at deerlab.com. When you're ready to purchase, you can use the code Wisconsin, all caps, for 20% off of any plan. That is deerlab.com, Wisconsin, all caps, 20% off of any plan. And then finally, Huntworth. This camo does not disappoint. I've been testing their tarnin pattern lately in some new areas, some different kinds of terrain that I've hunted over the last couple of years, and it blends in really, really well. This year, I'm going to be hunting here in southern Wisconsin. I'm going to be hunting South Carolina in September, northern Georgia in October, and deep, deep South Alabama in February. And man, I've got confidence that that tarnin pattern is going to perform super well in each of these settings. It's a really versatile camo pattern. So go check them out, huntworthgear.com. Big thanks to all of those partners. Their support helps keep this show going so I can bring you great content each and every week. Now go show them some love. I know you won't be disappointed with any of the products from these brands. Now, here's my conversation with Alex Gramavat. Joining me for this week's episode of the Wisconsin Sportsman Podcast is Alex Gramavat. Alex, how's it going, man?
That's wonderful. Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, man. Thanks for coming on the show. It is a rough part of July right now. Where you are in Wisconsin was how hot yesterday?
About 99 and very humid and raining.
Dude, that's miserable.
Yep, there's a sauna, but it's short season. Gotta appreciate it in February.
Embrace it for all it's worth now, and remember that winter is coming.
Exactly.
Man. Well, Alex, you and I met through our wives, I guess. My wife and your wife ended up working out together at a gym that will remain nameless so that we protect the identities of the public lands that we like to haunt. And come to find out, you and I hunted the same piece of public and enjoy a lot of the same stuff. So we kind of hit it off. I've enjoyed getting to know each other. But let's kick it off like this for those who maybe don't know you. Who are you? Where are you from?
Sure. So Alex Grammelbot, originally from Tampa, Florida, moved to southern Wisconsin from Tallahassee, Florida, native Floridian, and just been an outdoorsman, enjoyed being outside pretty much my whole life. So it's a natural fit up here.
Yeah. Wonderful. So how long have you been hunting and fishing?
I've been fishing since I could stand. I was catching bluegills off the dock in my backyard in Tampa when I was like 2.5. Hunting, it's a complicated question. I hunted a little bit back home in Tallahassee area and kind of got tired of it for various reasons that I'm sure we can get into later. And so overall, I probably would say 5 years, maybe 6 years, something like that.
Yeah. And you did not grow up in a hunting family. Did your family fish?
For a while. It became a point of, I don't want to hurt the fish for my dad, who I grew up fishing with. He had this philosophical change, which is fine, to each their own. But he ended up where he wouldn't enjoy the fishing anymore. So we stopped fishing together when I was pretty young. He just had this change of heart where any type of animal should be protected, which I respect. I understand.
Sure.
I have a difference of opinion, but, we are definitely not a hunting family by any stretch of the imagination.
Yeah. What was that like for you as a kid? 'Cause it seems like you really enjoyed hunting. So what was that like for you as a kid? I mean, obviously, where you're at now, like you just said, respecting your dad's difference of opinion. But what was that transition like so like we used to hunt or we used to fish together, really enjoyed it, to now we don't do it anymore?
It's a roller coaster. I was bummed for a long time that something that I loved doing, especially back home, obviously in the Tallahassee area, we had a boat and we go out in the grass flats of the Gulf of Mexico and catch trout, redfish, flounder, all that. And I could never get him to come fishing with me. And there were a few years where it kind of bummed me out, but then I just sort of accepted it, that's his prerogative. That's what he wants to do. We'll do other stuff together. As far as this transitioning into more into hunting, because I love living up here and I love fishing up here, but you can't replicate grass flats and chasing speckled trout in 5 feet of water. I love that.
Sure,
and
sure.
I love trout fishing up here. But it's just not the same. So I do enjoy fishing up here, but I definitely would say that hunting has become more of a priority up here than fishing has. So that being said, that transition and trying to explain to them has been a challenge, and it's something that's still underway. It's hard to have a conversation about why my opinion on this changed when there's no receptiveness on the other side. So, I mean, I grew up not knowing any better, right? Hunting is bad. It's for people who are overcompensating. It's for people who just like to go kill stuff. And I didn't know any better, right? I believed all that growing up because I just plain didn't know any better, didn't have any other experiences. So I had an epiphany probably in my mid-20s that, why? Why is that bad? Why is that inherently bad? How is it any different than farming and harvesting goats or sheep or pigs or chickens or cows or pick any domesticated livestock, and how is it any different than a fish, than killing a fish, which I eat trout and redfish all the time. And it just kind of caught myself in my own hypocrisy of what I believed, and my opinion changed. But it's tough with parents that aren't receptive to even having that conversation. So it's something I still tiptoe around. We'll talk about, I guess, a little bit later about the deer that I got this year. I haven't even told them that I hunted deer this year or last year. That's hanging in the living room. That's going to be a shock for them when they come in, because I'm not taking it, taking the mount down, but it's something that we tiptoe around. We have an English setter. He's a bird dog. He's a hunting dog. And he's as sweet as can be. And they, my dad called him a murder dog. So there's this just, it's a challenge. And I don't know. I wish I had the golden ticket to solving this problem, but I don't know what the answer is. So it's just something I try to avoid, which is pretty awkward and unfortunate.
Yeah, man. I think that you're probably not alone in today's, you know, the general ethos of our society right now. And a lot of people have family that are not just, it's not just that they don't hunt, but they're anti-hunting. They're against hunting. Have you found, I know you said you try to just kind of tiptoe around the issue because it is awkward and it is a hard conversation. Have you found any inroads, you know, if there's anybody out there thinking, I need to have these kinds of conversations, have you had any success with these conversations? Or is it just like, you know what, at this point of our relationship, it's just not worth that difficulty that comes along with the talk?
I feel in individual moments like I might have had like glimmers of success, and then one step forward, two steps back. I feel like at times there's a sense of understanding. I had a conversation recently with my mom about something, and she was like, "Oh, what are you eating for dinner?" I was like, "Oh, reading The Last Pheasant from last year for dinner." She's like, "Oh, well," and she, you know, got all weird about it, and then was like, "Well, I'm going to go into Publix and grab some chicken." I was like, "Well, you know, I hope those chickens didn't feel any pain when they died." And she was like, "Oh, they did." And I was like, "So how is that any different than a pheasant?" And she kind of got quiet for a second, was like, "I don't want to have this conversation now." So at a minimum, I think she knew that I got you a little bit.
Yeah.
And it's not like I'm trying to get you. I'd rather have an open discussion, but it's hard when there's no receptiveness. So I wish I had any type of advice or anything positive to say, but I don't. I don't know what the answer is, because it comes down, this isn't one of those topics that's just from the perspective of like my folks who are anti-hunting. It's not just being anti-hunting. It's a moralistic thing. They think they're morally right, which is fine. I understand. Ending a life is a hard thing to do. It's a hard thing to wrap your head around. There's emotion involved, unless you're a sociopath. There's emotion involved. Okay. So it's not just as simple as, yeah, I killed it, right? You have a connection that you ended that animal's life. So it's not as simple. It's not black and white. And when you bring moral arguments or moral stances into a discussion like that, you're not just talking about the topic at hand. You're talking about how somebody personally feels in their core about something. And the hardest opinion to change.
Yeah. Would you have considered yourself anti-hunting before you started hunting? Or was it more of just I don't do it, I think people that do it are silly, but I'm just going to kind of stay over here in my own lane?
A great question. Yes to all of the above.
Okay.
I understood it, I guess. I fundamentally understood it. I didn't really have any desire to get involved in it. I wasn't sure how to process ending something's life like that, through different means than catching a fish. And I mean, I club all my fish for what it's worth, because I would hope somebody would do the same for me if they caught me by a hook, right?
Sure.
And just end it as quickly as possible. Make why let anything suffer, whether it's living it alive well or slowly just dying on ice. I just hit him over the head. I was anti to a point. There were areas of hunting that were more black and white, things like bear hunting, things like trophy hunting, that I have now changed my opinion on. Do I want to go shoot a rhinoceros? No, I have no desire to go do that. But it's hard to not be a hypocrite. So why is the life of, actually, my argument on this is, comes down to gestation period. So a blue whale, the life of a blue whale or an elephant is inherently worth more than a squirrel, because it takes them like 9 years to become, you know, reproductively viable. So that's kind of where I draw the line in my head. But the cute and cuddly argument doesn't work. So bears have multiple cubs a year. How is killing a bear any different than killing a deer or killing a rabbit? And the answer is it's not. And so I would see things like that, and I kind of drew the line at cute and fuzzy, cute and cuddly, things like ducks. Like, why would anybody go hunt ducks? They're so beautiful. It's just a small duck. You know, why is that worth it? And then I started duck hunting, and man, this is fun. The hunt itself is so much fun. So I don't want to say I was anti-hunting, but I leaned more that way, I guess you could say, previously, until I just started questioning my own opinions and saying, why do you think this? Do you think this because you were told to think this for 25 years of your life? Is there a logical reason to think this way or not? And that, so questioning myself got me to where I am today, as far as my opinions on it. And who knows, those could change in 10 years too. I could have another major epiphany. Like my dad, for instance, he had an instance where a situation in Vietnam, he accidentally killed a water buffalo. And that's what actually was a turning point for him. That it was in this war zone and he accidentally killed this water buffalo. And it just kind of shook him to the core of, why is that water buffalo's life, like, it's an innocent water buffalo in this situation. Like, the people that are trying to kill you aren't, but, and that's when it all changed for him. It was that one defining moment. So I could have that defining moment next year. I don't know. But For now, at least, I think what I've got is a reasonable, logical opinion on this that is based in logic of the situation, of questioning my own opinions, questioning facts of these animals and just facts of human existence. It comes down to how humans have existed forever versus the last 50 years when commercialized agriculture has put everything in little styrofoam packs in the grocery store. So that's different. It's a new phenomenon, in my opinion.
Yeah, yeah. Tell me about then that. When did you decide? So, I mean, you were fishing, right? And started to ask these questions. How did you transition then into, well, I'm at least going to try hunting? Because I imagine you weren't like, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to buy all the gear. I'm going to be a diehard hunter this year. Like, I imagine that was a little bit of a process for you. So can you kind of explain how that transition worked?
Absolutely. A friend of mine back home, actually our friend's dad, quit his job as an engineer, said, I've had enough of working for other people, bought a farm, and that was that. So we would go out and help him and learned a lot about growing food, about where your tomatoes come from. I was a townhouse at the time I was in graduate school, and I started growing vegetables out on the deck and was like, wow, I can do this here. Like, you don't need a farm, but that experience of seeing him go from complete suburban Corvette driving engineer to, you know, farmer sinking his tractor in the mud and having to get it pulled out and go kind of going through that process with him, was eye opening. So there were deer obviously on the property. There were small Florida deer, Actually saw an albino deer out there once, had it glassed up, and I couldn't pull the trigger. There was no chance I could shoot that deer. Man. Yeah, it's cool.
They're not exactly common down there.
Not exactly. It was the first one the only one I've ever seen, but
wow.
I had a couple of friends that hunted out there, and you know, a buddy of mine got a couple of does and helped him clean them. And, he had guinea fowl out there. So we would harvest some guinea fowl, got some goats from the neighbor, and we harvested some goats and ate goat meat for a while, and sort of just by proxy getting thrown headfirst into the deep end of this more rural lifestyle that was appealing. I went out there for fun for a reason. So I'm an Eagle Scout. I guess I should probably mention that I grew up in the outdoors, not hunting and fishing like my parents wouldn't like, but backpacking. I did 50 miles on the Appalachian Trail. Being involved in Boy Scouts for so long and doing all of these outdoor activities, you know, you go to college and you just go to the college bars and do all that and live that lifestyle. And there was always something missing. So this opportunity to get back into, quote, the outdoors, even from an agricultural standpoint, was huge. And it's something that I did because it was fun. So just kind of by proxy of these deer are here, and how is that deer any different from the chickens that he would raise, or the guinea fowl, or the goats, or the cow that we bought part of from the guy down the street? How is that any different? And it was kind of an eye-opening experience for me and really just built more of a connection to your food has become so cliche, but connection to this world that's bigger than us, and how humans in the post-industrial world have existed since the beginning of time. And it was like instinctual. I hate to use the word primal because of certain influencers on Instagram who have overused that word and made it kind of depressing. don't forget to eat your raw liver for the day.
I was going
to
ask if you've been eating liver.
I mean, I saved the liver from that deer, nose to tail, but not a huge fan. Definitely not eating pounds of it raw every day. it feels almost wrong to not embrace providing for yourself. It's kind of anti the human experience up until the last maybe 100 years. And it feels right. It kind of lets you get out your inner chimpanzee or inner Cro-Magnon man and go provide for yourself and feel a sense of pride that you can. What you can do, you can feed yourself. That's huge. People need food and shelter and air, clean air and clean water to drink. So if you can provide for your own food in one means or another, whether that's through, you know, small scale agriculture, which I'm a huge fan of, growing food outside, like we have a garden, or hunting and fishing, why would you not? Isn't that part of this human experience?
Man.
And part of what makes the North American model of conservation so great. I'm sorry to cut you off, but
no.
we have a unique opportunity here that this model of conservation that our country is built on, you can't do that in Europe. That's been banned from the common folk for centuries. It's only for the elites. And I know there's some movements to get that access more opened up, but something so wonderful about living in this country and something that, almost negligent, in my opinion, to not try to take advantage of to some extent, whether it's foraging. You don't have to go kill deer every year or elk or hunt doll sheep. Go forage. Go forage for mushrooms and ramps and all of that stuff. It's awesome. It's an opportunity. It's a missed opportunity if you don't take advantage of it.
Yeah, man, I love the way you put that a second ago of like, if I don't take advantage of this, I'm missing out on a piece of the human experience. And like, I guess I've never really thought about it in those terms before, but it really is. Like, I mean, that is a huge part of what it means to be human, at least like you've said, until the last 100 years when things have been very, very different. But yeah, man, I want to embrace that. And I want my kids to embrace that. I mean, that's a, That's huge. So tell me about the moment that it all kind of came into fruition or came to fruition for you, like when you went hunting and took that first deer. Like, what was that like going from where you were and sort of this, I don't know, awakening going on? And I'm sure it's developed a lot since even that moment, but tell me about that.
I don't think the deer is probably a good example of that. I guess probably, to be honest, those guinea fowl were really the first thing that I realized. This is no different than anything else. And then the goats, of course, they're goats, right? They're cute. They're goats. But like, put it in perspective of a life is a life. And then I remember very clearly, I went on a quail hunt back home in South Georgia and busting coveys of quail under English setters and thinking and looking at those, they're so fast and they're so small and they're such good and so evasive, and looking at those five, six, seven quail that we had, and was like, wow, you are so perfectly adapted to live in this environment. You do it so well. And how is the life of this palm-sized bird any different than anything else? And it just all sort of clicked pretty quickly over that time frame. And it got to hunting on that farm back home that it kind of became a circus a little bit, just because of the sheer volume of guinea fowl. So it almost didn't feel like hunting. It kind of felt like, I don't know, felt like something else. But I'm happy to talk a little bit about the hunting that I've done up here, which I think is much more, and kind of my hunting style up here, that is completely different. And that deer here shook me a little bit for different reasons, but I think it was more because of the style of hunting, and that it was, in my opinion, that was a hunt. It wasn't sitting over a baited corn pile, you know, waiting for something to come in and deciding, yeah, maybe not. But we can get to that in a little bit.
Yeah. I mean, man, so your transition to now, like when I met Alex, like, Alex, you're full on opportunistic outdoorsman. And I say opportunistic in the sense of like, whatever is available to chase right now, that's what you're chasing. Like, you're all over the place.
Absolutely.
Not opportunistic of like, you just go out and shoot whatever's there. Like, you're out intentionally going after whatever in whatever season is open. Through this process for you, not having a family that hunts, what have been some of the influences or the resources that have helped you? Because I imagine there may be folks listening to this show who are maybe coming from a different or from a similar experience as yours, or from a non-hunting family. Have there been resources along the way that have just like really helped shape and form not only your perspective, but how you go about doing all that you do? Because, man, you chase everything.
That's a great question. Of course, there have been some people along the way who have helped me, you know, here and there, offered advice. But I wouldn't say that I've had like a mentor, a single individual who really taught me from beginning to end of hunting anything. Most of the change happened, and I guess I should preface this with, the last few years in Florida, I stopped hunting just a little bit that I did. And we would hunt hogs and stuff back there too, but I'm petrified of snakes. Terrified, biggest fear in the world.
They suck. They're the worst.
They're miserable animals. They're the worst. So I stopped hunting down there mostly because it's so damn hot all the time, sitting in a deer blind and sweating and just dripping sweat, knowing you're just reek, isn't exactly fun. I don't like being hot, and potentially stepping on snakes and water moccasins all the time just kind of, I don't know, took away some of the fun. So I stuck to what I knew, what I did best, which was saltwater fishing, which is fun. So up here, when we moved, I wanted to be outside. in all seasons. I guess I should also preface this with, we had a 3-year stint up in the Wausau area when I was in high school. So I did have some prior experience with Wisconsin, and but about 3 years in my teens when, try to forget those times. but so like I had ice fish before, right? But I would not say I was an avid ice fisherman. I had done it a handful of times when we were up here before, but wanting to get out, I want to go ice fishing. I want to be outside because of this change of season, or the change of seasons, that what you've got now, you've got for a few months and then it changes. You damn well better appreciate it while you've got it. And is it going to be cold? Yep. But days like yesterday, I wish it was 10 below zero outside. And when it's 10 below zero outside, I'll be thinking of days like yesterday and be like, man, can't wait for that change. But it changes. It's cyclical. It's natural. So when we moved, I started just trying to be outside as much as I possibly could, for one reason or another, whether it was hiking, after we got past the move itself, for whatever reason, I could be outside. I wanted to be outside walking trout streams just to go catch, you know, tiny little brown trout and, little rainbows, just because I can. Why not? It's wonderful. It's all close, that we were lucky. That we're very fortunate to live in an area where within about 15 minutes, I can do pretty much anything that I would please, outdoors wise. So why not, after work, drive 15 minutes, go walk trout stream for an hour and a half, and then come home. And you used the word opportunistic earlier, and that's exactly what it is. It's opportunism in the sense of trying to take advantage of every opportunity that's in front of me when I can, and there's not enough time to do it all, which is great. It's a hell of a problem to have.
Yeah.
It all started when we moved here out of just the desire to be outdoors as much as possible. And it just sort of evolved and grew from there.
Yeah, man, I've mentioned some of what you just said on this show before, of the differences between outdoor recreation in the Deep South and outdoor recreation in Wisconsin. It's dramatic. Like, unless you have walked through water moccasin ridden swamps before the sun comes up, you haven't. I mean, it's bad.
Yep.
And sitting in a deer stand when it's pushing 90, it's really, really bad.
A buddy of mine duck hunted back home, had an alligator try to climb into his kayak at like 3:30 in the morning. Nope. There's a reason I never duck hunted back home. And bet your ass, that's why. There's no way. It's just not worth it. It wasn't fun. It took the fun out of it. For me, at least down there. And I mean, stingrays and sharks are bad enough, and flesh eating bacteria in the Gulf of Mexico is bad enough. But those are all things that they're more reasonable and that I can accept and deal with. But there's a reason I didn't even like hiking back home unless it was January or February. It was just too hot. And too many snakes and all of those things that I just plain don't like, and just took the fun away from it, or for me at least. It just kind of took some of the fun out of it.
Yeah. And another piece that I want to touch on here is access. Now, obviously, down where you were, saltwater fishing, anybody with a boat, it doesn't even need to be a nice boat, you can go out and catch some fish, especially on a nicer day when you don't have to worry about, you know, storms popping up on you or anything like that.
But 2 days a year.
What's that?
2 days a year when you don't have to worry about storms popping up.
Both of those days you get out there and it's fantastic. But really, like, when it comes to public land, I mean, almost everything you do here is public, right?
Absolutely. I think I've got one property that I hunted last year for like the holiday hunt. I just randomly stumbled upon a private property, and I got offered another one this fall, which we'll see how that pans out. But absolutely. Everything that I've done here is on public land.
Yeah. And you're chasing, at this point, ducks, pheasant, deer, turkeys. In fact, we both hunted the same turkey this year. Neither one of us got him.
Yep.
He was
sad.
Dude, he was too visible, man.
Yep.
You knew he was going to die.
I know. And the one day I had him coming in, I had to get back to work for a work meeting, and I was kicking myself because he was coming in, and sad times. But lessons learned. That was my first spring turkey season, so I considered it a success that I at least saw one. I didn't turkey hunt back home. So I'm trial by fire, right? Learn the field. And I did. So consider
success. And for those folks who do listen to the show a lot, you'll know what turkey I'm talking about, because that's the one that he was roosted on the edge of public right by private. He was very visible on this private field, and somebody ended up shooting him right out of the tree one morning. I'm set up on him just, 150 yards from him or whatever. And boom, somebody got him right out of the tree, which disappointing, but hey, good for that guy. Right. Glad that somebody at least got him. So, all right.
Sort of good for that guy. I was heartbroken to hear that next week after my tags were done. It broke my heart.
Dude, I've got the video and I've showed it to my wife, who's in that tall clump of trees, and I've got my video camera pointed at those trees, and I'm all set up and stuff, and I barely start to call, and I'm zoomed in on those trees, and all of a sudden you just hear the gunshot go off. And it's the most depressing video to go back and watch it. But I've kept the footage because I go back and I remember that morning, he gobbled too many times. The thing must have gobbled 50 times. I mean, he was just getting after it. So, he kind of asked for it.
Yep. Yes, he did.
Hey, guys, just want to take a quick minute to let you know that the Wisconsin Sportsman Podcast is brought to you by Tacticam, makers of the best action cameras on the market for the hunter and angler. They're on the cutting edge making user-friendly cameras to help the everyday outdoorsman share your hunt with friends and loved ones. They also just launched the Reveal X Gen 2 cell camera that provides top-notch photo and video quality at a price point that's in reach for the everyday outdoorsman. And one area Tacticam really shines is with their mounts and adapters that are made with the sportsman in mind. If you've tried to film your hunting and fishing excursions, you know how frustrating it can be to try to get an action camera aimed just right, or get it attached to your weapon, or in a good spot for a second angle. Well, Tacticam makes all of that a breeze with their line of accessories. This fall, I'll be using their stabilizer mount on my bow with the 5.0 camera, and their bendy clamp paired with the 5.0 wide camera for a second angle, and to make sure that I don't miss any of the action. To learn more and check out their full line of products, head over to their website, www.tacticam.com. Share your hunt with Tacticam. This episode is also brought to you by DeerLab, the number one trail camera app for hunters and land managers. DeerLab gives you a simple way to store, organize, and analyze all of your trail camera data. DeerLab has tons of great features like the ability to filter photos based on what's in them, like deer or turkeys or people. It syncs your photos with local weather to help you pattern your target. And you can even mass edit your timestamps if you're a goober like me and you forget to set the correct time on your camera. Head over to DeerLab.com to check them out. You can use the code Wisconsin at checkout for 20% off of any plan. That's 20% off of any plan. Just use the code Wisconsin. Now let's get back to the show. Well, man, we hunt one of the same public pieces. You had a heck of a deer hunt out there this year. And before we jump too far into how your season ended up, what had you done deer hunting wise sort of leading into the season? Had you hunted much on that property prior to the day you got the deer you did?
So I crossbow and rifle hunted. Last fall was our third hunting season, third deer season up here. I had hunted the other two seasons unsuccessfully. It was half-hearted. I will fully admit in hindsight, it was half-hearted, but I had, hunted to some extent those first two seasons. And my neighbor has a cabin up in northern Wisconsin that we had hunted unsuccessfully too. How it goes, the deer disappear as soon as opening gun season, they can't find them. They're out there on camera the day before. But so that property in particular, I had not extensively deer hunted. I cousin hunt a lot out there, and I got into pheasant hunting. Actually, my neighbor has a dog, and I started just hunting by myself, solo hunting, and just loved the solitude of still hunting without a dog and being able to really hone your senses into hearing a pheasant's footsteps, hearing them a single cackle and identify reed cover where they might be. And I thought it was so much fun to chase down a bird like that without a dog. We now have a dog, completely different experience, love him to death. But it's completely different. Waterfowl hunting has become my solitude. But so I had pheasant hunted a lot out there, and I had kicked up deer. I'd physically almost run into them before, sneaking around, kick up a doe 5 feet from you and scare the daylights out of you. So I knew there were deer. I knew roughly where they were because I would walk, especially without a dog, I'd walk the thickest cover I could find out there to try to find those birds that were getting pushed by people with dogs. So I knew the property pretty well. There's so much sign out there, it's almost tough to read, but you can kind of figure out over time where the highways are, where the crossings are, where the bedding areas are. And so I kind of just absorbed this almost unknowingly when I was pheasant hunting. And so when I did go out and deer hunt, I didn't really have a plan. I was just kind of wandering aimlessly around, trying to work the wind in a loop that I knew, hunting the thickest cover that I could find in hope of finding and picking one up, and I was still hunting. I did climb a tree for a little bit and sat in a tree for a while and heard some bucks that were they were getting after it together, but I never saw them. So just still hunting around where I had seen sign pheasant hunting.
Yeah, and I know the area you're talking about, there was really big sign in there. Like it, this place you're talking about, yeah, there is a ton of sign. The deer there just really, I don't know if there are necessarily a ton of big bucks there, but man, the sign is everywhere. But you ran across some, I think some pretty exceptional size rubs and stuff like that up on that portion of the piece. So the hunt, the day of the hunt, you had not deer hunted that morning. Is that right?
Nope, I had actually goose hunted in a field that morning, and it did not go as planned by any stretch of the imagination. So I came home frustrated, sat behind my laptop and worked for a few hours and said, you know what, I'm going to go deer hunt. This is nonsense. I don't want to be behind a computer. So grabbed my rifle and went.
Yeah. All right. So you get to the spot. Your plan is I'm going to walk through. I mean, by the time you got there, the other gun hunters were gone, right?
Oh, yeah. I got there at 9:30. In the morning, something like that, mid-morning.
Yeah, which is strange to me for this place. I mean, I had hunted there opening day of gun season, and man, the place just cleared out. And I'm like, what, all these people just think the deer left, or I don't know.
I think people like walking 100 yards from a trail and about 100 yards in, and then they sit. And one thing I've learned, hunt the hunting pressure.
Yeah.
Don't hunt the animal, hunt the hunting pressure.
Yep. So you went to a spot that was not necessarily a high pressured area, but there had been a lot of pressure around it, right?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. And your plan was to just kind of walk through this area slowly where you had seen the sign and try to key in on something. Did you expect anything to happen, or were you just going for a walk with a gun?
Pretty much. Just going for a walk with a gun. Every time that I've been out there when I said, do I hunt deer today? No, I'm going to hunt pheasants. I'll see deer. And every time that I hunt pheasants, I kick up deer. And so I expected to see nothing. I thought I was just going to blow off some steam, go for a nice walk on it. Like in the maybe low to mid 40s, it's a beautiful day. So it's like, it's a wander. And maybe I'll see something. But I hoped my game plan was just, like I said, to walk that thick cover that I knew they used. And I had seen them either bedded down or kind of slowly passing through. And there's a lot of bedding areas on this property. And I think and they do a lot of bedding down on this property and then go to private at night to eat. So I knew there were deer around. I'd seen sign that had all these spots marked on Onyx where I'd seen sign, and I kind of hit a lot of these rubs that I had seen. And just still hunting. So looking for an ear flutter, looking for some antlers sticking up above the grass, listening for like those two bucks that I heard going at it, listening for them, and then trying to sneak around and see, can I see them? And the answer is no. any type of activity, any type of sign, try to read fresh tracks, gaps, stuff like that. See if I can just essentially kick one up. So I've kicked up enough deer out there to know they generally run to an edge and then they stop and then they look back. There's so much hunting pressure with people with dogs that I think they kind of have grown accustomed to hunting pressure. And if I'm saying too much on this, by the way, feel free to edit any of that.
No, you're good. That's one thing I've noticed on this spot too. I had, not this past year, but the year before, I had a small 8-point feeding underneath me. It was like November 10th or something like that. And he was kind of feeding around. I was just downwind of a doe bedding area. But he was kind of milling about, didn't seem too interested in does or anything like that, just kind of feeding. And a lady walks by with her two dogs. And I can hear the little like bells on this lady's dog's collars. And for some reason, they just, this buck looked up and watches the dogs walk by. The lady walks by. They never notice this buck standing there. And he just goes on about his business. And this spot is pretty heavily pressured, but it receives more pheasant pressure than anything. And I think that the deer, like you said, have just grown accustomed to it. Unlike some other areas that I've hunted where it's strictly deer hunting and they do not put up with anything.
Yep. And I think it's important to mention too, that this property is heavily recreated from people kayaking and people just playing. We walk both of our dogs out there as soon as we can. And the leash thing goes out of effect in the end of July, August, whatever it is. We just go take our dogs for walks, and it's a very highly recreated property. Yep. So I think that's exactly right. Just reading kind of what's going on around doesn't mean there aren't deer there. It just means you have to adjust your style, but it might not be your traditional deer hunt of sitting in a stand all day, freezing your butt off, waiting for that buck to walk through. It's trying to read what's going on around you, not just habitat wise, but pressure wise, and adjust accordingly. And isn't that the fun?
Yeah.
Isn't the fun of deer hunting is adjusting what you're doing to the situation.
That's right. That's right. And so how far do you get from your car before you start seeing deer on this particular day?
I only saw one and I got him.
Yeah.
So on this day, if I remember correctly, I think I walked a total of about 9.5 miles.
Wow. Okay.
And I mean, it was through the thick crap that nobody wants to walk through, right? So all these thick, dense briars and all the mucky wetland areas and all of that. I'm sorry. That's what my Garmin watch told me. My step count was after the fact. So I had probably, and that included hauling the deer out and doing all of these other shenanigans. So maybe I had hunted 6 miles,
okay.
6.5, 7. I don't know how many steps I had taken at that point in the day, but I hadn't walked 200 yards. I mean, it was a long day of traversing thick cover and muck and semi-frozen wetlands and all of the things that make deer hunting in November wonderful of, am I going to break through the ice or am I good? So I had gone through everything, everywhere that I expected a deer to be. This dense stuff where there was sign, hadn't seen hide or hair of anything. I think I heard a couple of roosters cackle. And like I said, I did hear those two bucks going at it, but I hadn't seen much of anything except for a guy walking his dog and got to pet a black lab. And that was about the extent of it.
Nice.
So as far as this deer goes, he was about 900 yards, I think, from where my truck was parked. Not 900 yards as a crow flies, but probably 800 as crow flies and maybe 900 total walking distance. He was right where I started. I probably walked right past him on my way out, and he just didn't move. And are you good with getting into the story of this?
Oh, yeah, let's go for it.
Okay. So the wind that day was out of the south, and so I had planned my whole day trying to walk into the wind to remain upwind of them, and nothing. So this instance, I was walking back to the truck. My legs were tired. I was, 40 degrees. I was still sweaty, carrying a rifle all day. I was kind of just trudging back, not expecting anything. And I was coming from downwind. He had to have scented me from a mile away, but he held tight. And I heard him jump up, and he stopped, and I knew what that sound was. I knew I'd heard him kicked up enough deer that he jumped and didn't move. he waited a minute and ran and just happened to run to the tree line, which gave me a perfect line of sight. And I had tags for both antlered and antlerless out there. So basically I was like, oh, if it's see a deer, and as long as it's not like a yearling, you know, as long as it's got a little size to him, go for it. So he was running. It was I do not condone running shots on deer for what it's worth, but it was a wide open low grass field. I had a very stable shot, and shot twice, hit twice. And furthest shot was about maybe 80 yards, 75, 80 yards. First one was probably 20. And second shot was a double lung shot, took a few steps and went down. And he actually went right into the tree line and went down. But I didn't know this at the time. You know, I just saw, and I saw it had antlers, and so I was like, oh, but through the scope at four power, it looked like a decent deer. But I don't know, in the moment, especially after walking that much with all the adrenaline then of that deer kicking up, it's not like just sitting there and watching them come in from 300 yards to within shooting range and you're, you know, slowly twiddling your thumbs waiting. It was all more like hunting a pheasant that you don't know is there, and that bird flushes and you got 3/4 of a second to raise gun safety off and shoot or don't. And so it was more like to think that my duck, goose, and pheasant hunting paid off in that situation. And that's why I was able to get a reasonable shot, or I guess I could say a good shot in hindsight. But yeah, he was probably, he was within 1,000 yards of the truck, not far at all. And found him after hours of walking, playing. It was like 1 p.m., 1:30 p.m., something like that, middle of the day.
And how far was he from you when you kicked him up?
15 yards. I mean, like a terrifyingly close distance when he jumped up. It actually scared me with all that dry grass and stuff out there. He let me get right on top of him before he moved. Man. And the fact that he jumped and stood still, didn't just jump and run, I found really interesting when I played this through in my mind after the fact.
Yeah, I think that speaks to the pressure out there on this place. And like these deer are just used to getting pushed around. I was out there for the opener of pheasant season last year and was sitting in a tree, and I had a young 6-point come and bed down in a little clump of brush like 40 yards from me. So I sat there and watched him. And I watched how this thing related to where the pheasant hunters were coming in. And as the pheasant hunters would move to, let's see, I was facing north. As they would move to the east, he would get up and rotate around to the other side of the clump of bushes and lay back down. And they would then turn and work their way back over to the west. He would get up, rotate around the tree, and bed back down. And he didn't spook the whole time. I mean, they got within probably 50 yards of where this deer was. And he held tight the whole time.
Did they shoot any roosters out of curiosity? Did they shoot at all?
They shot a couple of times, but I don't know.
That deer didn't react to the gunshots?
He did not react to the gunshots at all. Like, didn't even, not even a flinch, didn't jump up, didn't do anything. He just held tight to the cover. And the only time he ended up getting up was when I had a couple of bucks come running through the exact area where I was. He jumps up then and he watches them, you know, and then he kind of trots off just a little bit. And then I shot one, put a bad hit on it and all that stuff. I've shared that story on the podcast before, but yeah, I think that just speaks to how deer adapt to pressure on highly recreated areas like this one, where they don't know what's what. And if they go running 3/4 of a mile every single time something jumps them, that's not going to be good for them. You know, the best thing they can do is what this buck did. Jump up, look around, figure out what's going on. And man, if you'd have had a bow in your hand, he'd have been fine.
Yep.
You know what I mean?
Absolutely. And, hey, there are nine days a year when he wouldn't be fine. And he had avoided that DNRH this year at 3.5. The taxidermist said there's no way that based on his diet out there and the lack of roads and stuff that he was guessing he was 5, 5.5, something like that. But a deer had avoided those 9 days for years. However, let's say 3 to 5 years, 3 to 6 years. And that's fascinating to me.
Yeah,
that's
it is.
Absolutely fascinating.
It is.
But it just shows the adaptability of nature. I mean, on a tangentially related note, the term nuisance geese. I know the city of Madison, at least up here, I hate this with every ounce of my being, but they deem some of the Canada geese, the resident Canada geese population, a nuisance because they poop on the beach and they poop on the little bike paths where the people like to go walk their little golden doodles and whatever they do, go rollerblade. And so they euthanize all these geese every year because they're pooping on the sidewalk and on the little like places where they sit. And I actually had a citizen resolution for the Conservation Congress last year about doing more outreach and trying to engage hunters in these opportunities, because I love goose hunting. I love eating geese. They're delicious. And the fact that these geese are just being euthanized by the city for doing nothing more than adapt to the environment that they're in is unbelievable. And one of the most ethically screwed up things that I can think of that just poisoning them to kill them. I can't wrap my head around it. I just plain can't wrap my head around it. But bunnies in the neighborhood, all the turkeys that are in the Madison area that have adapted to urban environments are fine, right? But somehow the geese aren't. And it's something that I just plain hate, that you have additional opportunities to let hunters help be a part of the solution. If the solution is pooping on the sidewalk, goose pooping on the sidewalk, use your best resource, which is your hunters.
Yep.
And there's a way to do that safely, right? You don't have to be Jimbo out there crushing bush lattes and just firing off a shotgun downtown Madison. I understand why that's frowned upon, but there's a responsible way to do this. And poisoning however many geese a year isn't it. And I don't know ethically how those people can sleep at night. So getting off my soapbox on nuisance animals.
No, that's good, man. That's right up there with some of these other projects where, you know, cities bring in sharpshooters to reduce the deer population. It's like, how about have a whole fleet of bow hunters who are more than happy to come in, do special classes, special training, show you that they're efficient and effective with their weapons. And then instead of spending money for sharpshooters, you make money off of special tags, and it opens up opportunity for people who live in these cities who may not have the same opportunity as folks who live in more rural areas.
Absolutely. I'm a firm believer too, on the permitting side of it or the licensing side, there should be annual strict testing to prove your abilities to do this, to weed out some of the folks that would be taking these sketchy shots. But then you see things, I don't know if you noticed or saw this a couple of months ago on the Journal Sentinel, Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, they had a deer in urban Milwaukee that had a bow or a bolt or a, had an arrow, I'm sorry, obviously from a compound bow through its head. And a deer was walking around in urban Milwaukee Park, and somebody had tried to poach it and shot it through the head with an arrow, and it wasn't a fatal shot. And that just blew up. And all these people saying, what the hell is wrong with hunters? The fact that it was a poacher, you know, you should not ignore the fact that somebody was poaching that deer.
Yep.
That's not an ethical shot to take with a bow. But so you have these things working against us as well, that any outreach efforts, any opportunities like that, somebody records a cell phone video while rollerblading with little muffins, their dog, and eating granola, takes this video of this deer with an arrow through its head. It goes viral, and now 10 steps backwards to even having any productive conversation on it. And it's really unfortunate. It's unfortunate from multiple sides. It's unfortunate that deer had that happen. That's unfortunate. That sucks. You shouldn't be in that situation. It's unfortunate somebody was poaching. Like a law or not, you should probably abide by it, unless you have a moral reason not to. And I'm not sure poaching deer in urban Milwaukee is a reason, a moral reason to not abide by a law.
Sure.
But there's so many potential opportunities, and everything's just become so polarized that you can't even have a discussion. And I really think it's a shame. Urban coyotes are another thing. They're just adapting to their environment, to what the environment that we've given them. It's our fault. We're encroaching on their on their habitat. And I don't think people should just be out slaughtering every coyote that they see because they serve a reasonable purpose of predator control. You like waterfowl, we'll get coyotes out there to start killing some raccoons. Nest predation goes down. So I know that's a potentially controversial opinion, but it's just an example of how animals are adapting to our environment. And who's to say what's right or wrong? Who's to deem what's a nuisance or not? We should cohabitate and we evolve together. All of us do.
Man, that's a good idea for a whole other episode, talking about nuisance animals, how municipalities deal with them, how we as hunters can be part of the solution, but maybe how we should think about it in terms of, you know, neighborhood encroachment on native habitat. So, man, that's really good. Coming back to this deer that you shot, the DNR aged it 3.5. Man, if this deer was 3.5, I'm not saying that the DNR doesn't know what they're talking about. I have a lot of respect for the Wisconsin DNR. Love having people from the DNR on this show. That deer was a giant. That deer was a freaking giant. What kind of form did the taxidermist put it on again?
So he ended up buying 2 foam forms that he uses for mule deer. He bought the biggest one and then the second biggest one. Thought he would use the second biggest one, ended up using the largest form, and then actually had to do a bunch of stuff with clay to fill it out. And the taxidermist, he does not send his hides off to a tannery, so he is fully able to control shrinkage and stretching of these hides. So it is as close to the size of that animal as it could possibly be. It still has all the whiskers and like the hair inside the nostrils and stuff. He did a phenomenal job. But to DNR's credit, and the only reason they aged it was because we did get tested for CWD. There's no reason not to. I had processed the whole deer and had it in the freezer and was waiting on that result. And I'm not sure if it came back positive for what it's worth, but what I would have done, I think I probably would have eaten it anyway for various reasons. But we at least got it tested because it's a good practice and a good reason to get the DNR more data. So shout out to DNR for DNR or CWD testing. But so they aged it based on tooth wear, which I also saw that and came to that conclusion when I looked at the teeth. But like the taxidermist pointed out, these deer, tooth wear is dependent on their diet, the same as hoof wear. That if they're walking a lot of paved roads, like your dog, our dog's toenails, when we walk them on sidewalks, get filed down because they're walking on pavement versus grass. Same thing with the deer. So the hoof, the wear on the hoof itself and the wear on the teeth, it's an indicator, but it's not the be-all of how old that deer is, because if it was eating softer things, more of a natural diet, like grasses and forbs and stuff like that, the teeth wouldn't wear as quickly as anything else. So yes, it's a good indicator. I know they can look at the enamel, I forgot what the technical word for the enamel on the teeth is, and try to age that. But those are all environmentally controlled based on diet and other things. So just based on the sheer size of this deer, it didn't make sense that it was that young, but I might put my foot in my mouth and maybe it was, but it was a big deer.
Yeah. So what did he end up scoring?
So I didn't weigh him, first, I guessed around 200, 225 pounds, not field dress. Taxidermist said that based on all the deer that he's seen, he was guessing it was upwards of 250. So it scored 162 6/8 gross, and final score was 155 6/8 because of those damn deductions that Boone and Crockett gives for abnormal points.
Nets are for fish, man. We go with gross score on this podcast.
Yep. So with that, 162 6/8.
Man, that is crazy. I mean, realistically speaking, if this had been a 3-year-old deer, you could be looking at a 200-inch deer at 5.5 easily, if he was 3.
I guess. And that's the other thing that didn't make sense, that the circumference on the antlers was I don't remember what the number was exactly, but it was not small. But he was big, and he also had his G2, I think, was broken off. So potentially could have been, if that was a full grown time like it is on the other side, could have been pushing 170. But he was not, and not to mislead anybody who's listening to the show, it was 162 and 6'8".
Man, a giant either way. Like the head on this thing, I couldn't believe it. When I walked into your house and I saw the size of this deer's head, I mean, it's the biggest deer head I've ever seen.
Yeah, I mean, he was bull rut, and just the neck, the circumference of the neck was just, it had gotten to the age, and I can give you a picture. I don't know if you want to post have on your podcast page a picture of this deer, but it had gotten to that size and age where not only was the neck peak rut and girthy, but the chin was starting to go away. Like it didn't have that bottom jaw leanness that a lot of them had. It started to look a little bit jowly and a lot of muscle on there. And it was huge. It was an absolute monster. It takes up our ceilings are, I think, 9 feet tall in our house. And the mount is mounted. I actually hit the ceiling when I tried to first mount it. I dropped it down a few inches, but it goes from literally the midpoint to about 2 inches below the ceiling. So from bottom of chest to where the leg started to tip of the antlers up on top, about 4.5 feet.
That's crazy. This thing is an absolute giant. So I'm guessing you're going to be hunting this same place this fall.
You know, I got a sneaking suspicion that I might.
You might be back out there. Well, hey, I just found out about a week and a half ago, maybe, I'm going to get to spend 14 days hunting this year. So November 1st really? Through November 14th, I'm going to have off to hunt. And I'm going to be sneaking around that spot as well. So, yeah.
You better call me too, because we can go put some geese down that time.
Heck yeah, man. That's, you know, my hope is that I can get a buck early and then enjoy some of the other things. Because I told you last time we had dinner together, like the thing that I'm most sad about after my last couple of years in Wisconsin is that when deer season rolls around, I just get locked in. And it's like, I can't do anything else other than deer hunt. I don't think about anything other than deer hunting. So hopefully I'll be able to create a little more space in my schedule this year to enjoy a little bit more of what Wisconsin has to offer besides just deer hunting. And I've actually had, so shout out to some of the podcast listeners here. I've had some folks message me and be like, hey, you know, Wisconsin has a lot more than deer. You talk about deer a lot, and it's like, yeah, I know. I love deer though. It's just,
well, it's alluring coming from the part of the country that we come from, where a big deer is 125 pounds, 150 pounds if you're really lucky.
Yep.
To up here where 200 pound deer is big, but just the sheer volume of deer up here is unbelievable, and the amount of opportunity up here is unbelievable. So, it's hard to not be, have your brain controlled by that.
Yep, absolutely. So, man, what are plans for you coming up? So we're right here in July. Have you been scouting for the summer, or are you just kind of taking the summer off and enjoying all the other pursuits that Wisconsin offers right now?
I've actually been building a little duck boat over the summer, and it's just been too hot, and I don't do, even though I'm native Floridian, I don't do well in the heat anymore. So
sure.
I have not been out a whole lot, but assuming not much is going to change, my plan is basically, I think September 1st, if I remember correctly, is opening of early goose, and start goose hunting then, and then see if I can find somewhere to find some early teal during teal season. Maybe not, but at a minimum, try to put some geese in the freezer and get married a few weeks later.
There you go.
No better way to lead up to a wedding than some goose hunting, and then play by ear. And it's really whatever the day brings, short of those 9 days of gun deer season that I feel some moral obligation to deer hunt. Wake up at a ridiculous hour in the morning and say, what do I feel like doing? Do I want to load the boat up and go hunt ducks? Or do I want to go take crossbow and go hunt deer? Or do I want to take our dog or bear and go hunt pheasants? What do you want to do? Go hunt squirrels, rabbits? What do you want to do? So that's my plan.
Nice.
No structure.
There you go. There you go. Well, Alex, thanks so much for coming on, man. And this was last minute, by the way, for those who are listening. I texted you yesterday. I was like, hey, any chance you want to record like tomorrow? And you were like, sure, let's do it. So I appreciate you coming on, man. Yeah, and definitely do get me those photos for this deer so that we can post it with the episode when it goes live.
I absolutely will do. Thanks for the opportunity. I really appreciate it.
Absolutely. Anytime, man. And that is all for this week's episode. Thank you so much for listening. Thanks to Alex for coming on. He and I have actually been texting back and forth already about some ideas for some other episodes this coming fall. So excited to have him back on pretty soon. Big thanks to the partners who help us keep this train rolling: Tacticam, Huntworth, Deer Lab. Go check them out. If you enjoy this podcast, share it with like-minded Wisconsin sportsmen and women. And until next time, get outside and enjoy the incredible resource that is ours as Wisconsin sportsmen.